This is a Cyber Union talk show for Monday, October 31st, 2011. We figured we'd do a show on books. Welcome to the show. This is Stephen from Occupied Boston, Massachusetts, and with me is...
Walton in Glasgow, Scotland. Stephen, how's your week been? How's Occupy Boston?
It's going well. It's going quite well. It's still growing, still a lot of learning to do, a lot of cool things going on in the tech side of things, as well as the movement as a whole. They've actually committed a transparency working group to help other working groups be open and transparent in their procedures and being more inclusive and welcoming. Not that they've been entirely exclusive, but it's been a noted criticism from some people, which is a good constructive criticism. So, but it's been going along well. The Occupy movement's growing into many new places. In fact, there's been unfortunate news going on, which was the Occupy Oakland got raided, and there's some links that we'll put in the show notes about it if you hadn't seen it. But the police ended up using tear gas and rubber bullets to evict the Tent City in Oakland, which was horrible, actually horrible to see. But there is one shining moment among the police with the Occupy movements was in Occupy Albany. The Governor Cuomo had been asking the mayor of Albany to evict the Occupy movement there. And the mayor reluctantly did so and ordered the police to do that. The police actually said, no, we're
okay.
Not.
Wow.
There's a really good article about it, but it's quite interesting because the police went as far as saying, I think, and I might be quoting here or paraphrasing at least a bit, which is let the police do the policing and not the governor or mayor. And basically they're saying that it's very peaceful, that it hasn't been causing any problems, there hasn't been any violence. And they felt that if they actually tried to evict that it would incite a riot, and they did not want to see that happening.
So that's some quite good news.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's still many other places where they've been evicted, even down in Australia. Occupy Melbourne was evicted, as well as I think Occupy Chicago, and there was stuff going on with Occupy Atlanta recently too. But the good thing is it's growing and it's getting stronger every day. So
I mean, for me, the really important thing is that the movement becomes a mainstream movement, and that it's not seen as something made up just of outsiders. In the UK, people, you know, the mainstream media has sought to portray people in the Occupy movement either as benefit scroungers or just, you know, students with a bunch of free time. And there's been a real attempt to discredit them. And I'm sure it's the same in the US.
Yes.
But the one thing that I found really interesting about Occupy Oakland when there was the raid was that someone was seriously injured, and it was a Marine, a US Marine. And I've subsequently seen that there's a website called Occupy Marines, and it's a U.S. Marines or former U.S. Marines who support the Occupy movement. And, you know, I guess they have a certain esprit de corps and a sense of brotherhood that feels deeply offended by the fact that they went to fight for freedom for their country and came back and stood up for their freedom and got shot by the police. And, you know, it seems to me that the movement can be going in really interesting ways when you start getting the kind of people who are often the heroes of the right and standing up to be counted for Occupy. So it's all very interesting stuff. And for me, the crucial thing is to defend Occupy as a space. I was reading a really good article in The Guardian today by Slavoj Žižek. He's the Slovene philosopher from Ljubljana who writes really interesting cultural criticism from a Marxist perspective. And he essentially, his point is Occupy now, demands come later, and that the occupation forces open a political space. As soon as you start making demands, you're negotiating. And in the society we live in, you're negotiating on enemy territory. And, you know, there's a real need to kind of consolidate the movement and to force open the space in consensus, because, you know, his big argument is that we have been told that we live in the best of all possible worlds. You know, things can't get better than neoliberal capitalism. You might make a few tweaks here and there, but the model is the best possible model. And by refusing to participate in a negotiation with neoliberal capitalism. And by having this occupation, it's people saying, we don't believe that anymore. You know, there is, there have to be other models, and we're not sure what they are, but we're not just going to go home, or we're not going to support some reformist political program aimed to kind of whitewash the very real collapse of politics and economics. So really, it opens really interesting political questions, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I feel the same way over here. Like since the occupying movement has been happening, is that there's a space for a discourse that hasn't been really in the public sphere in a long time. At least I can't even think of in my own lifetime, maybe during the World Trade Organization, WTO in 1999, but I wasn't as conscious at that point. But even then, this seems much more long going from a lot of people who have been involved in that. And there's a whole change in the discourse, and that a lot of the stuff that was in the media that was that has been, you know, the Republicans and the right wing, and not that I'm giving any support for the Democrats, because they don't have my support either. But that their discourse about, you know, more elimination of regulations and more freedom for corporations, all this other stuff, that's not as prevalent as it has been since the Occupy movement has happened. It's become that's something they start having to defend more, instead of it just kind of being accepted by the media. Not that the media is entirely on anybody's side or on our side, because they definitely aren't on the side of the Occupy movement, but it's definitely cool to see the space being created, and that that space needs to be continuously going. And if we're going to get any changes, we can't give up on this. And I think the more that the state or the corporations attack, the stronger it's going to get. And I mean, there's discussion, you know, let alone the state coming and intervening in California, there's discussion about the concerns about Twitter, Facebook, and Google starting to censor. And there's concerns about that. And people are starting to think about how we can work around that as well, which is really cool, because it does bring in some stuff that we've touched on. So, but it seems pretty promising. But how are things been going over in your side of the pond?
Actually, really bad news from Occupy Glasgow, and that is... very recently, a woman was raped at the Occupy camp.
Oh, dear God.
Sort of late one night by, it sounds like, a group of drunk young men, a gang who are kind of out looking for trouble. And unfortunately, the Occupy is in a part of the city center where there are often problems with sexual violence, sexual assault, and indeed just general violence, and you know, just highlights the kind of lack of safety that people feel in modern cities. And it makes me realize that, you know, while we're talking about defending the space on a philosophical level, it's also very important to secure it physically, and to secure the safety of the people who are there. And, you know, it seems to me that the Occupy movement is going to have to do something about security and self-defense, and watching each other's backs, because, you know, you're in a tent in the middle of the city, you've got enemies out there, and you're vulnerable, and you need, you know, you need some protection. And I hope that we can coordinate something to keep people safe, because, you know, it's a really important movement, I think.
I mean, I think the cool thing, not that there's anything cool about that, but since this movement's been gaining so much power over the internet, that there's a lot of ways of sharing resources, because I know the Occupy Boston has a public safety working group, and safety is a big concern given its location, and they've been dealing with a lot of people coming in there trying to get free clothing and then selling it for drugs, and it's been something that they've been trying to prevent from occurring. So they've, you know, the GA's passed policies, but there's also people kind of watching out for others and making sure that there's no disruptions happening, because some things have gotten stolen and things like that. So there's always that kind of conscious concern. But then, you know, dealing with things like in Glasgow, that's definitely something that these different Occupy movements need to share their tactics and strategies as much as they can on the internet, which they are. It's just a matter of trying to figure out how to create a central resource for that. Specifically, and what strategies they're using, because I'm sure New York City and in Lower Manhattan, where they are, is not exactly a safe place either. And, you know, Oakland, you know, even though they completely lost their space, these are not exactly safe cities. But, you know, the occupying movement's bringing people who are good and can have that oversight. And it's just a matter of making sure that they have the tools to build those safety mechanisms, I guess you could say.
Just from a tech perspective, do you know about the app called I'm Being Arrested.
Yes, it's actually I've heard about that, and it's been going around, especially since what happened here in Boston a couple weeks ago now. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, people finding out about that app didn't happen before then, but before then, even during that whole situation, the National Lawyers Guild that had people who are watching had given out phone numbers and to write on your arm because they know that they'll mm-hmm. take your cell phone from you. Mm-hmm. So they can have some number to call when they get in there. So there are ways that you can actually get rid of the technology somewhat. If if you're about to get arrested, hit that button if you have that application. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, make sure you write the number down on your arm.
just for listeners who are wondering what we're talking about, there's an app for Android and iPhone. That you pre-program with a message and as many phone numbers as you want to add, and you put something in, hello, this is so-and-so here, I'm protesting and I've just been arrested, please do the following. And then there's a big red button. And so as soon as you get arrested, you hit the button and it sends out that message to your entire network so that the message spreads quickly and you don't disappear somewhere and it takes a while for your friends to find out where you are.
But yeah, I mean, and just in light of all these things, just really one little quick thing I was going to say is if you're not actually near an occupation and you are supporting it and they're being trying to be evicted by the police, one of the few strategies that people don't realize is very beneficial is actually if you're trying to send messages to both the police and also to the mayor's offices and everything like that, if you have a fax machine or capability of faxing, fax a letter. They have to read that stuff. Mm-hmm. They can't just throw it away. And you can call all you want, but they're not documenting that as much as they have to when it comes to something that's written. And it's very easy nowadays with technology to either emulate a fax machine to get something over through your computer or whatever. But mm-hmm. just something I want to give out as a tip.
Okay.
Anything else going on over in Glasgow on a shinier side of things?
It's been a really, really busy week. I think I mentioned a few shows ago that there's likely to be a massive strike on the 30th of November, a big public sector strike, which will potentially be the biggest strike in the UK since 1926. But currently we're balloting for it. And that is a huge admin task because we have to make sure membership databases are completely flawless because if there's any mistake in the ballot, if someone gets a vote and they're not supposed to vote because they're going to stop working before the strike or anything, the strike can be challenged in court. So we have to be really rigorous in the preparation for the ballot. So a lot of the union's resources are being tied up in the balloting process at the moment. So it's just a generally quite busy and stressful time. And I think probably a lot of activists in whatever field they're in are feeling a similar thing. You know, there's quite a lot going on at the moment and it's tiring.
Feeling pretty tired. I bet.
Anyway, what distro are you on this week, Stephen?
how'd you guess? well, this week I'm running Debian and Wheezy, and it's mostly because I was running into some issues with Vanillix, which I actually still have installed on an external hard drive, so I can actually still boot it if I wanted to, which I didn't realize I could do that until recently. It's much more stable, even though it's the testing branch. It's kind of equivalent to what you're running with Linux Mint. Mm. But the good thing is my wireless card is working again, mm-hmm. though there is a free software version wireless card in the mail that I will be replacing it with anyhow because it's been too much of a headache for the last couple of months. But so yeah, I'm on Debian, back to Debian Wheezy or testing, if people don't know it as testing. So it's good. It's good now at least.
It's good to be back with old friends, is it?
Yeah. But some other tech stuff that I wanted to go over, if we could jump right into tech section if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Great. So one of the things I actually did get, and this came via IRC with this guy Dave in the Cyber Unions IRC, we were talking about some of the stuff that I'm planning on doing when I go down to Guatemala. One of the thoughts that came up was, you know, trying to set a server up, and I didn't want to be bringing a big piece down there or setting mm-hmm. one up. And he had suggested to test out Tonido Plug, and I decided for the heck of it, it was only like I think $100 or $115, and I decided to buy it and test it out and hopefully this works. And I got it and it's pretty cool actually. And just the other day you and I were actually working mm-hmm. with it. It is essentially, for those that don't know, going to be could easily replace Dropbox or any dependency on the cloud, because I have an external hard drive connected to it and I'm able to log into it from outside the house. And I can stream whatever music I have on there onto whatever device I'm using, or watch whatever shows I have on there. And I can also have access to files. And then I can share those files just like people do when they're sending a Dropbox link.
Yeah, I mean, I'll explain to the nice people how it appeared to me, because you've obviously got it plugged in, but I'm somewhere else. And basically, it's a plug that you plug into your router and to your hard drive, and it provides an interface with your router so it can be accessed from anywhere by someone who has a link, which it creates. So for me, Stephen sent me a link and said, log into this. And I get a web page and it says, you are a guest at Stephen's Tornado plug, and these are the files that you can see. And he's pre-selected some things which I can look at. So the experience for me is very much like going into Dropbox, except that none of the stuff is stored on a cloud. It's stored on Stephen's external hard drive, or if he installs a hard drive, I think, in the Tornado plug, it'll actually be stored on the plug, which means he can unplug it and take it with him. And he's physically got that data with him all the time. And he's not relying on a cloud server somewhere. So I think, unfortunately, they're not available yet for the UK or Europe. I think they're only available in the US. But I'm really keen on getting one myself. Because as he says, you can access your entire content from anywhere in the world. And that's fantastic, I think.
It is. And there's if you're running 32-bit version of Linux, you can actually install the Tornado app. I have the 64-bit version of Linux, which is a little bit more tweaking I have to do to get it working. But you can also actually sync up with it, too, similarly to Dropbox, which is pretty cool.
And there are also iPhone and Android apps for it as well, so you can very easily access files from your phone if you need to. So
yeah, exactly.
Immensely useful, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So, and according to at least Dave, when I was talking to him, I can actually use it to install different distros onto the device if I wanted to. So I'm going to hopefully jump back into the IRC with him at some point to try to figure that out. Yeah, so it's pretty cool.
Okay.
But other than that...
I was just going to say, how's the packing going? Because I know you're moving to sunnier climes soon, and I was wondering how the process of packing up is going.
Quite well, actually, and that's a good thing to bring up, because it brings us to something I want to go over, which is I've been packing a lot of books, and while going through them, I started thinking about different books that I could recommend to people that are listening to the show and view our site on. So do you want to jump into some books that we could go over?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, let's read some books.
Cool. So it's actually kind of coincidence with the IRC too. There was another person on there that was asking me about it. And then there was some other people that I ran into on Occupy Boston's IRC about recommended books when it came to certain topics that I was talking about at the time. I ran across some books that I haven't seen in a long time, but they're books that were very interesting to me when I read them. And I still think they're very interesting reads, especially for people who may want to get to know a little bit more about the labor movement itself. The first one actually is one that we both have, which is From the Folks Who Brought You the Weekend. And that book, when I read it, I thought it was great, because it was kind of like a brief, not a brief, it wasn't super brief, but because it's not, although it wasn't a long read, I guess, but a really good synopsis of like the history of the labor movement with a bit of a U.S. focus on it, and is talking about, quite literally what the title is, The Weekend, and where it came from, and how the IWW was a big part of that, and responsible for why we all have it. And when it's funny when people talk about, oh, you lazy bums, blah blah blah, stop, go get a job and everything, I'm like, well, the weekend is why the reason you have the weekend is because of the labor movement in the first place, so don't be dissing the labor movement.
Yeah, it's a fantastic union history. And what I really like also is that it's got great comic illustrations by Joe Sacco, who's, for people who like graphic novels, he's quite well known for doing Palestine, Safe Area Gorace, and a number of other kind of politically themed graphic novels. For someone who's not in the US, it gives a really good insight into where the US labor movement comes from, and introduces you to some really, really interesting characters. Mother Jones and Crispus Attucks and all these people who became, and obviously Joe Hill, kind of martyrs and pioneers of the US labor movement. And it's a fascinating read, and a really important part of U.S. history, which we don't hear enough about. Because, you know, it's about, we have the impression of the U.S. as being this melting pot. And what the book demonstrates is that the melting pot was often formed in struggle. You know, during the Ludlow massacre and the, when people were fighting against mine companies, it was large groups of immigrant miners who, had to learn to get along with each other in order to fight a common enemy, which were, I think, the copper bosses. And, you know, that's where the real melting pot that is the United States was formed, was in struggle with people having to learn to rely on each other. So, fantastic book. I'm tempted to also recommend the film Make One at the same time, because it deals with one incident out of U.S. labor history, John Sayles' film, and it's a fantastic film. So,
yeah, no, that is a good movie too. Yeah, that's definitely a good movie. I actually have that one too. Although I don't know many labor movies that I don't actually have.
So
in one form or another.
Since you're doing books, I'll bring in a book as well, and it's a book by a guy called Paul Mason. Paul Mason is a BBC journalist. I think he's economics editor for Newsnight, but he's also a prominent trade unionist in the National Union of Journalists. And he has a book called Live Working or Die Fighting. It's essentially a very, very good introduction to the trade union and labor movement for someone who doesn't know a huge amount about it. You know, you maybe know it from the news, or maybe you're a union member, but you don't have a sense of the movement's history and why it is the way it is. And it's really, really interesting. Essentially, he's arguing that the conditions that gave rise to the birth of the labor movement in the first industrial revolution, first wave of the industrial revolution in the 19th century in the West, we're now seeing similar conditions in places like China, India, and the global South. So our union movement in Britain and the US came about through the kind of history and struggles that you read about in the book Stephen just mentioned, The Folks Who Brought You the Weekend. And in a way, you know, our unions have declined a bit in the West, and to some extent it's because they've been successful. You know, working people until the recent austerity attacks actually enjoy not bad terms and conditions compared to people in the global South. And so people have forgotten to an extent why it's important to keep fighting for that. And Paul Mason shows how other countries, developing countries, are going through their own industrial revolutions, and people are reaching the same conclusion that people in the first wave of trade unionism reached, that they need to work together and fight together to build a better world. And he's a journalist, so he writes really well, and the stories are gripping and powerful and quite moving, and there's some really interesting industrial and social history there, so that's well worth the read. And I definitely say that anyone interested in labor history or trade unions in general, it's one of the first places I'd start.
That sounds really good. I was gonna kind of add transitionally, because it kind of goes with it, the book that I thought when I read it when I was in grad school studying the labor movement, is called The Next Upsurge. And
okay.
For
well,
anybody,
that's promising.
It is. And my first initial reading of it was just like, it seemed depressing to the point, because it's talking about when labor made its greatest strides is during social movements that were going on at the same time, or labor movements themselves. And, you know, it does a really good job of answering the question that a lot of people have, which is, why isn't labor doing more? And a lot of the power, like people talk about politically and everything, and now in the U.S. we don't have a labor party, so we're limited in that structure, but we don't see great strides and strengths in the labor movement except for when major things were happening both domestically and globally. So like the biggest writing of the National Labor Relations Act was during the Great Depression, and there was a huge movement afoot at that time. And what the book does a really good job of basically describing when labor makes gains, and when labor unions and workers are able to make gains in the system that we're in. And it's just a timely piece, because it kind of answers a lot of the questions that some people who don't know that much about labor would be wondering. And I think it's a really good piece. The author is, from a sociology perspective, easy read, and his research is really well done. And I really liked it a lot when I look back at it now. Like at the time, I was just like, all right, just waiting for the next upsurge. Well, guess where we are right now, is we're in that upsurge. So it's pretty cool to see in that sense. So it's definitely worth the read. The other one actually, which is kind of a story, which kind of, I guess you can kind of say, touches with Mate One, because it's regionally from the same area, but it's about the steelworkers, and the book is called Ravenswood, which is a phenomenal book because it really kind of goes through this whole process of the steelworkers that were fighting for a contract. They've been a union for a long time, and they started dealing with a different type of management that was much harsher than previous management. And the book does a really kind of good development to understanding basically how global our economy is and how that impacts like bargaining. Mm-hmm. And it takes this great story because these workers with the union decide to do all this research about the company, and their research unravels into a tremendous amount of things. And the book literally, and I'm not trying to force people or get people to buy it, but it has real suspense and intrigue to it because there's parts where people were almost killed because of how defensive this owner was. Mm-hmm. And it's what's interesting too is the person that they ended up going after and successfully pressuring was pardoned by Bill Clinton, of all people. Hmm. For I believe it was tax evasion, if I remember it correctly. But he had been exiled from the U.S. for God, I can't remember how many years. But it's a really interesting piece, and it even has a little bit of an excerpt of understanding why the Jamaican bobsled team existed, which is really took me by surprise when I read the book. It's not something you'd expect to read in this book. You're like,
a cool runnings reference in a book about labor struggles is unexpected.
Yeah, which was a great movie too. But anyhow,
I guess just to add a brief note for the cyber part of the cyber unions is I read a really interesting book recently called A History of the Internet and the Digital Future by an Irish guy called Johnny Ryan. And it's exactly what it says. And I found it really, really useful because it explains the history of the internet and hacking and how it developed. The really fascinating insight it gave me to hacking culture was he writes about phone freaks in the 1960s. Have you ever heard of them?
Yes, I have actually.
and it's, you know, it was kids who were able to make long distance phone calls by whistling the tones that the phone system used to make connections, and they kind of, you know, it was like a kind of in a way really, really primitive hacking. And you know, to realize that it goes back that far. That there've always been people who've been able to hack the technology and make it work for them. So obviously, you know, it's all about how the internet was born out of the Cold War and the realization in the Cold War that Central Command was really, really dangerous, because if the evil Soviets drop a bomb on Central Command, then there's no one to give orders anymore, and you've got all these isolated warheads all over the country with no command structure anymore. So there was a realization that they needed a distributed network because it would be more secure. And if one command center gets hit, the communications network doesn't go down. And that is still the primary thing that gives the internet its power. And that's also the current weakness, is that there are all these political moves to end the distributed peer-to-peer network of the internet and try and force it into choke points, which are controlled by the states or by corporations. So it's a fascinating book just for that, the kind of for the history. Mm-hmm. I love the phone freaks are mostly blind kids who were really, really good at sound and tones because they were compensated for not being able to see. And just that was a really, really interesting story. So totally recommend that one.
Yeah, that actually kind of reminds me of the one I just finished reading recently, which was How to Think About Information by Dan Schiller, which covers a lot of the similar things. But the reason I like him is he wrote a book that I like called Digital Capitalism. And that book actually is one to throw in there because it's a little bit older than the one I most recently read. But it does a really good analysis of what digital technology and everything has done to the workplace. The piece really does a great job on really just showing and discussing and analyzing the impact that digital technologies and software and everything like that has had on how workers have been alienated even further from the work that they're doing. So like one case in particular that it went over was talking about teachers, but professors, and looking at the schools online. There's one that's really popular here called the University of Phoenix, and it discusses how the workers and the teachers were basically losing their power because of technology. They didn't have the same abilities to organize. They didn't have the same methods to organize in that case, because, you know, they're all over the country, all over the world, and basically discussing how technology has alienated workers from the power that they have. And I mean, I mm-hmm. I think I've said this enough times, is that, you know, it's about worker power in the workplace, not, you know, whether it's more productive. I mean, productivity is important, but if you give more power to the workers, they're even more productive than management can ever have. And it's just really a pain in the neck to see how technology is utilized to take power away from the workers.
you have mentioned that once or twice over the course of these podcasts, Stephen. It seems to be a bit of an obsession of yours.
Yeah, and all of that. I guess that's true. I mean, worker power is very important to my thought. But I wanted to add another book to the list, and kind of segueing from digital capitalism into the other critiques of capital, which is a piece by David Harvey.
David Harvey.
Called A Brief History of Neoliberalism. And in that piece, it was really good, because he does this phenomenal job of, and writes it really easy reading to not really have to feel like you need to understand full economic policies and theories and everything like that to understand how neoliberalism is working. And what I really liked about the piece is just the simplicity of the way he explains it, and the analysis of how we're seeing deregulation of everything, and what corporations and capitalism is trying to do is give themselves more power by taking it from those who have it. Mm-hmm. In this case, the government has some regulatory powers. But it's a really good piece overall, just because it makes sense of what we're currently in, because we are in a neoliberal capitalist economy right now. And people don't realize what that exactly means, because they seem to associate this ever-streaming flow between post-World War II to now, and skips this period that started in the 70s of deregulation and eliminating everything that came under the Keynesian economic model. And I think it's a really good piece that kind of informs a lot.
Well, yeah, if I can jump on the David Harvey bandwagon, what I would say is there's nothing like an economic crisis to improve your understanding of economics. And past couple of years, I've read some really, really fantastic economic stuff, some very, very good, succinct, well-argued stuff that explains in great detail exactly what's going on and how deep and structural the crisis is. And I kind of think we almost need to do a whole show on some economic theories, because it's important for union people to actually know that there are ideas out there that explain things. And it's not all about trying to prop up the current system, which is what you see in the media. But I would say, if there's only one book on economics that you ever read in your life, I'd probably go for The Enigma of Capital and the Crises of Capitalism by David Harvey. Because he basically takes a long view of capital. He goes back to the start of capitalism and explains how essentially capitalism needs to grow to survive. And he maps it out, and he figures out that on average, over the past 350 years or however old capitalism is, it's needed to grow at a rate of about 3% per year in order to survive. And if it doesn't get that growth rate, it goes into crisis. His diagnosis, his theory is, capitalism ran out of places to grow to in the early 1970s. And it was able to put off that final existential crisis with the financialization. In other words, it created bubbles, fake things that don't really exist, you know, derivatives, all these financial instruments, which aren't real things. And then it was able to kind of grow into all these bubbles and create all this wealth. Now that model has collapsed, and there's no way left for capital to invest in. So there is still money in the world, but there is an investment strike, because if you have a huge hedge fund or pension fund or huge amount of capital, there's no way that you can put that capital and get enough of investment to make it worth your risk. And there doesn't really seem to be a way out of that, except either war, destruction of capital and naked seizing of other people's assets, which is what happened in the 1930s, or a transition to some kind of to a different political system, you know, which could include seizing all the capital that's sitting there unproductive and forcing it to be productive, which is it's a conversation for another day. But I think it's an important book to read to understand why the prescriptions which are coming out of a lot of politicians are just not going to work, because You can't restore profitability to a system that's fundamentally broken. Very, very good, fascinating read, and it's really helped structure my thinking about economics. Gets you thinking about the political economy of economics, like what is economics? And economics is supposed to be the study of the most efficient allocation of resources, but it isn't. It's become the study of, the whole study of economics has become falsified. And, it's really a social science as well, because it's about people and the way people behave, but it's been presented as a hard science. And that book also helped me to understand how there isn't a perfect economic model that fell from the sky. The Keynesians or the Marxists or the Hayekians are correct or something like that. Economic systems grew organically and people have attempted to analyze them. And this is the best analysis I've read. It's the one that makes the most sense. So I would recommend it to anyone. It's very, very good. And it's readable. I mean, it's complicated in places because economics is a rich field, but it's quite readable. So that would be my main book on economics I'd recommend. We can get into some others on another show.
Good. I think that kind of covers enough books for a couple weeks for people to kind of brush up and read on if they get the chance to. And of course, we'll put links in the show notes for people to find out where they can get those books. So with that, I just wanted to see if there's any feedback that you want to go over today.
No more feedback. I just wanted to say happy reading, people. The days are getting darker and shorter and colder up here in the Northern Hemisphere, so there's more time for reading, and we've given you some recommendations, so go and get clever.
Great, in solidarity with the Occupy movements out there and the workers of the world, and see you all next week. Happy reading.